ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hello everybody, welcome to this episode of the Attention Please podcast. Before we begin, an appeal to all my listeners that if you like this show, if you want to show support, if you want the show to continue, then a good thing for you to do would be to become a monthly Patreon. Contributions start at $1 a month, so it's not a lot. And this is not just a way of, sponsoring our production costs, but it is also a way of, and as I like to say, nothing shows that you appreciate something more than paying money for it. So again, as I like to say, there's nothing's going to be behind a paywall, so it's always going to be accessible. Everything is going to be accessible for people who do not pay. But again, if you like something, and we've been doing this for more than 2 years now, so I hope you already have formed an opinion as to how good or bad this show is. So if you like this show and want to show support for it, please consider becoming a monthly Patreon contributor. So, continuing on the topics that I wanted to discuss today. So, the first thing that I wanted to talk about is kind of a continuation of what I was speaking last time when we had an episode, which was about Twitter being banned in Nigeria. It's not really about Twitter being banned in Nigeria, but this problem that governments are now facing with big tech social media companies. And I think this struggle is going to continue. The banning of Trump, the continuous banning of Trump, has kind of been an inflection point for this struggle between big social media and national government. So to repeat what I had said before, the real problem started, the basis of this problem is the role of platforms like Facebook and Twitter. So at one point of time, these companies themselves argued that they should be seen as blank slates, that they will not police, unless it's some thing of respect to law enforcement, terrorism, violence, child pornography, things like we all agree upon, fairly unambiguously that these are things that should not be there. So besides that, besides things which could definitely be shown to be against the law, let's just say that, there was a broad leeway given to social media companies that they were not to be held liable for content that was on their platforms. So this was the way it was in the US. And of course, since these social media companies are based in the US, and the US has traditionally kind of set the legal agenda, for the rest of the world, this was the way it typically was, that social media companies were not held liable for speech on their platforms unless it was illegal. And you could show conclusively that speech was illegal and quote unquote immoral by fairly, I would say, universal standards, because there's always this, well, what if we make strict laws and make any kind of speech illegal, like, for instance, what China does or what North Korea does? So I that's why I want to take a step back and say it's not just illegal speech, but things which more or less pretty much all human beings agree are terrible things and should not be allowed. So other than that, there was a broad independence on the part of social media. And then things, of course, as the progressives, which I've always said is really old world communism, now shorn off some of the old communist vocabulary, but then appropriating the vocabulary of the day, kind of mainstreamizing itself within academia and then through widely read media outlets, web media outlets like BuzzFeed, they started, and the effects are very obvious, that we have had a culture shift over the last, I would say, 10 years, and definitely it's been accelerated in the last five or six years. So once when Trump came to power, these
these social media companies were now quote unquote held accountable by the progressives, that Russia hacked the elections, even though Russia didn't technically hack the elections. They couldn't have because the elections people voted and they won. So this was when Trump won, and Democrats and progressives started delegitimizing Trump's election, which of course, when they do, and when anybody does this thing, and whenever the extreme takes one of these extreme weapons, they do it because it's the easy thing to do without considering the fact that this exact same weapon is then legitimized and then can be used against them, which is exactly what Trump supporters then started doing when Trump lost the elections, by delegitimizing the whole process. Anyways, that's a topic for another day. But at that point of time, one of the villains of the piece was Facebook and Twitter, because they were apparently allowed themselves to be quote unquote hacked by Russia, who used the platform to spread misinformation about Hillary Clinton and spread fake news. And so they were to be held accountable from now on. And so the progressive agenda then became that, no, these big tech social media companies are sufficiently influential, and so with great power comes great responsibility. So they just cannot walk away from the table and say, it's free speech. As long as it's not against the law, there's really nothing we can do. They were then asked to take a stance. And the fact that the political ideologies of those in power in these big tech companies. And you have to understand that, you know, when we say big tech, you know, we kind of tend to think of these as large organizations, but ultimately it's a very few people in a large organization, the ones that actually have the power, that take these decisions. So these decisions does not represent the vast majority of employees of the company. It usually represents a very small fraction who are the people who are actually in power, who take executive decisions. So the decisions that sometimes appear arbitrary are because of the underlying prejudices and underlying biases of those people who are in power. So whenever I say Twitter or Facebook, you have to understand, I mean those that are called the shots within Twitter, Facebook. And it seems to be the CEO. The CEO is definitely one of them, but there are a large number of, I would say, you know, when I say large, I don't mean like thousands, but I would say there were 50 or 100 people without whose names we will never know, who are actually responsible at different places for, making sure that these companies do what they do. And these are not always employees. Some of them could be people on the board. Some of them could be, you know, very vocal shareholders, whatever it is. Ultimately, there is a very small number of people. Like progressives like to tell us that, you know, we want to take democratic decisions. We want to have everybody, the powerless need to have a say. No, when they take decisions, they only let people with power have the say, as long as the people in power agree with their opinion. So what happened was that, and I know I'm going over some of the stuff that I went over last podcast, but I also realized that many people don't listen to all the podcast episodes. I have to make my discussions kind of complete within a podcast episode. So at that point of time, Facebook and Twitter, they started taking a much more proactive approach to censoring, I would say, content on their platforms. So, and again, the moment you have some kind of censoring, that's when, at least in my opinion, the older version was much better, because at that point of time, you were just basically censoring speech that was illegal and immoral. But now you are censoring speech that a set of people in the company who had no, and again, this is a private company. So this, what kind of, and sometimes they said these were done in an automated way. But anybody who understands a little bit of automation would know that this is not true. And I'm going to come to that with the case of the blue tick removal of our Vice President Venkaiah Naidu. The logic or rationale given by Twitter is laughable. But before I come to that, so the way Facebook and Twitter kind of message these things was that because we understand that human beings have bias, we use automated machine learning, Booba, stuff to take decisions, which again, it sounds great when it's in a deposition to Congress, but anybody who's ever worked in technology knows that these kinds of machine learning approaches are never bereft of human bias. And what they do is they do a first order triaging, ultimately the decisions. It's Donald Trump's wasn't banned by a machine. he was banned by a committee of human beings. So whenever these kinds of decisions take place, you know, your post gets flagged, you and my flows, it might be looked upon by a machine, or it might be looked upon by some censors, which Facebook and Twitter appoint. They're, you know, poorly paid people sitting who are going over thousands and thousands of such posts. Again, there is what criteria do they choose to decide what satisfies community standards and what doesn't? So then they came up with this really vague, not made public notion of community standards, which again just meant that we were no longer censoring speech that was considered to be illegal. We were censoring speech that were against quote-unquote community standards, where what community standards was never specified in a public, in a transparent way, which basically meant that we are a private company, we will decide based on our business requirements or based on essentially the bias of our company, what we choose to keep and what we choose to remove, which again is a perfectly fine thing. And this is, again, it keeps on getting conflated with freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is a concept that is defined between the individual and the government. It is not a concept that is defined between the individual and a private company. It is not a concept which is defined between an individual and their employer. So no, you cannot badmouth your employer in a public forum and then claim freedom of speech. No, that you can badmouth the government. That is the only thing that you can do, because that is a freedom of speech thing. Your employer, not a freedom of speech thing. A private company, not a freedom of speech thing. So no, this has got nothing to do with freedom of speech. Anyways, but they had a right. You were signing on to their platform, a free platform, which of course you were paying with your personal data, but it's some kind of currency in today's world. So it's a commercial transaction. You have the right at any point of time to withdraw your consent to this contract by essentially deactivating your account. So it's fair. There's nothing unfair about it. But the problem is that with the internet increasingly becoming more and more part of our lives, and these big tech social media platforms have kind of expanded from being just a service that you can use and you can move to something else if you don't like it, to there is no other competition, essentially. So it's not the technology that is Twitter's that is responsible for driving up its valuation, because you know you have Ku, you can build another Twitter. That's not a big deal. And I said that's not a big deal. I'm not saying it's easy, but that's not where the value of Twitter is. It's the users that they have. And again, a very easy way of understanding is Netflix. And you know, initially, what made Netflix unique was its technology. It had the kind of technology that nobody else had. It kind of mastered the technology of internet at scale video streaming. And for many years, they basically took advantage of that, took the first mover's advantage. Then Amazon Prime came in, but still Netflix had a huge advantage. And then other studios, and once this technology became kind of a commodity, with cloud computing and with many AWS and Azure and all of them kind of building software as a service, which pretty much allows people without the core technical competence to build platforms that can do internet scale video streaming. Now studios like Paramount and the different studios, Disney, they all realized, why should we just sell our stuff to Netflix? We can, you know, making the technology in-house isn't that big a deal. We can make it and keep control over our rights. That's why Friends moved away from Netflix, and that's why Netflix is losing some of its content. And 5 years ago, the great thing about Netflix was that we could basically cut our cable. We no longer had to deal with, you know, somebody who was packaging 100 channels to us, of which we were watching just a few. And now again, we are back to that, because there are now essentially, rather than cable channels, there are a lot of these streaming platforms, all of which have claims to mine to one franchise, two franchise. So, you know, if you want to see it, you have to subscribe to that, which has kind of gotten us back. I know I've deviated a lot from what I was saying, but this actually shows what happens when you actually have choice. But in case of Twitter and Facebook, you don't have the choice. You are on Twitter and Facebook, not because of technology, but because everybody you know is on it. So that's what makes these kind of surpass the scope of what we usually consider to be private industry, because there is really no practical option to these sites. So either the option is that you don't speak at all online, or that you're voiceless online, or that you use these platforms. And with Facebook, let's say, acquiring other, like Facebook acquiring Instagram, is that even the other social media platforms that were, that it could kind of become a challenge to them, have all been acquired by the one or two companies, which essentially creates some kind of monopoly. So this is, again, I'm not saying that there are any simple solutions to this. Can we say that, no, Twitter has to be considered to be a form of human right? So your ability to express yourself on the internet and be heard by people is a fundamental human right that should be guaranteed. And ergo, Twitter cannot claim the privilege of being a private entity and say, we get to choose who we decide to let talk and who we don't decide to let talk. So we don't like Trump. And again, they didn't like Trump. So that's what, when they started, you know, tagging, when Trump started saying things like the election was rigged, that's when everything started. But there have been politicians in India who have been saying the elections have been rigged for years. Twitter has never taken a stance against them. Recently, we had somebody who was an anti-vaxxer, a prominent anti-vaxxer. She had her Twitter account suspended. Prashant Bhushan is a very prominent anti-vaxxer. You know, anything that this government does, he has tweets where he has criticized the governments for, this was before the second wave, for spending so many millions of dollars on buying vaccines where they could have given the money away to laborers and stuff, or on for basically a disease that was non-existent. So this is a person who's not a level-headed person. Let me just cross out that word. The word level-headed isn't what I was going for. I mean, a person who is speaking from good intent. He's not a person. He's an extremist. He's a partisan. But he is allowed to spew his anti-vax venom on Twitter from a blue tick account. And Twitter doesn't take any action against him, because I'm pretty sure that the powers that be, which is the Indian powers, have decided that silencing him would be silencing one of the prominent voices against this tyrannical, fascist, Brahmin patriarchal government. So that's why he is allowed to stand. So his elections are rigged, his vaccines are shit. All of this is allowed to stand. So this is what actually happens when, rather than allowing only speech that is against law, you start doing policing. This is exactly what happens. Bias becomes ingrained into social media interactions. And because of the power imbalance, because of the fact that Twitter can do things that we can't do to Twitter, that means the people employed at Twitter, again, a very small people, their personal biases, that becomes paramount. They can be influenced. Who are these people who take these decisions? Twitter talks about transparency, but we want to know who took this decision to, ban somebody. Who takes this decision? How is this done? What are the criteria that is followed? We don't know. How do we know that these people do not have political agendas of their own? How do we know? If we don't know who they are, we don't even know that. So, and this question of Twitter being banned in Nigeria because they had basically done to one of their politicians what they do to Trump, that itself raises the question again. Banning Twitter in the age of VPN is, of course, as we all know, is something which, banning a website is something which you really can't do until and unless you have the kind of draconian content power that the Chinese Communist Party has over their internet infrastructure. So until and unless you have that level of control, where there is no notion of user privacy for that country, where if you use VPN, they will pick it up. The government will pick it up. Unless you have that kind of draconian control, banning a website is pretty useless in this day and age. So I think this is going to be something, and I personally find it outrageous that Twitter and Facebook, they do this kind of asymmetric censorship based on based on their bias. And this is even more, this is even, there's a huge conflict of interest also, because these social media companies also run political advertisements. So they run political advertisements, and they're also in the business of censoring speech. So how is this even a thing, that a company which makes its money, among other things, in, you know, promoted tweets and running campaigns for anything, for any product, of which political parties are obviously a product, and obviously they spend a huge amount of money. And again, the BJP has done this too. So don't think that I'm just saying that this is a massive anti-BJP conspiracy. No. In this case, of course, so the BJP in this case has to spend money. So whenever the BJP spends money, one can at least say that, okay, BJP is spending money, so that's why the social media platform is censoring anti-BJP speech. The great thing about the anti-BJP people is that they don't have to also spend a lot of money, because they have people who agree with them in these positions of power who are taking these decisions sometimes. And if somebody isn't, or if somebody is of the opposite persuasion, they will find that they are under a lot of pressure. Because again, there is this cabal of people in these companies who actually take the decision. So it's a very small group of people, as I said, non-transparent. We don't know who they are. We don't know what the criteria is. But just by looking at the kind of decisions that they consistently keep on taking. And this brings us to the removal of the blue tick of Venkaiah Naidu. Now, again, we Indians, and we know that we love our blue ticks. So let's not, you know, say who really cares about our blue ticks. Of course, we care. People care about their blue ticks. And this was, again, an extremely churlish move on the part of Twitter. Whoever took this decision to remove the blue tick of, and this is not a BJP politician. This is not Mohan Bhagwat. Or, you know, this is the vice president of India. This is a constitutional authority. And removing the blue tick status, again, what does it even mean? I mean, why would you even remove? This is a reprisal. Again, it's a very silly reprisal on the part of a global company. I don't know who there decided to take this call. But it's an extremely cheap, petty, though effective, shot at this current government, and targeting, you know, of all people, Venkaiah Naidu. Well, if they really wanted to make it a war, they could have gone after Amit Shah or Modi, but they didn't. And again, this is usually what happens when you don't want to escalate to a full war, but you want to show that you are capable of doing something. And again, I'm pretty sure that people there realized, you know, level head, better heads there realized this is a really stupid thing for them to do. And so then they came up with this laughable, absolutely laughable response that this was done because the account had been active. When there are people who have, you know, there are accounts with blue ticks. People haven't tweeted for ages. Some of them have even, you know, are no longer in this world. And nobody, they don't lose their blue ticks. You know, you just don't, nobody does that. So this is, again, unless their contention is that the Venkaiah Naidu account has been hijacked or has been hacked, which they didn't say that, you know, they basically took. But even then, if an account is hacked, then the account should, you can basically lock that account before you validate the identity of the person using it. I totally understand that. And that should definitely be done for blue tick accounts. It should definitely be done for, and now everybody has a blue tick, I would say. But even within the blue ticks, there are some people who are important, right? Really important. I'm not talking about being on Big Boss important. I'm talking about really important. So definitely Twitter has the right to do something like that. But this, you know, not tweeting for some amount of time, and why would you remove the blue tick for that? Exactly what, how is the connection between, because a blue tick exists for a very specific reason. It exists to disambiguate an important account from any kind of imposter. That is the reason why it exists. Just because that person hasn't tweeted, let's even say that it's in universally accepted norm. Why would somebody's blue tick go away just because that person hasn't tweeted in a while? And I'm a blue tick, and when I signed up, there's no place where it's, at least I can recollect, where it said that if you do not use it for this length of time, your blue tick will be gone. I might have missed it, but it's not there. And we can look at, we can look online at blue ticks and find out there are many, many blue ticks who haven't tweeted in ages, Ravish being, I think, one of them, that have not had their blue ticks taken away. So this points to the main essential problem, that this is what happens when you provide these big platforms. And the progressives asked for this. At some point of time, sometimes even the progressives complain that Twitter is in the tank, is in the league, is working for the BJP. They also say that. But you know, all of us know that is not absolutely not true. Neither it is it here nor in the US. Because of the personal biases of those in charge, censorship will always be for a certain viewpoint. Now, again, I absolutely agree that when you have the kind of power that Trump has, your tweets should be fact-checked. But then this fact-check should be done uniformly based on some well-publicized criteria that if you have, let's say, so many followers or, you know, more than a million followers, or, you know, if you hold a position in government, then Twitter will fact-check you. But then that has to be uniform across all nations and across all political leaders. Okay, maybe we will not fact check, even if he might have like 20 million followers. We might not fact check, let's say, Salman Khan's Twitter account, because one can always say that is not politically significant. But then, yes, definitely. But then you should apply the same standards you do to a Malaysian politician that you apply to Trump, for instance. So again, the main problem here is a lack of transparency from Twitter and from Facebook. And I think that this banning in Nigeria, which again, I would say is a technical impossibility to execute properly. So that's why it's inadvisable. But I think this is going to be interesting times as Twitter and Facebook, now with Trump out of power. And the last thing I wanted to add is something which I said. If you recall, they started doing this to Trump after he had lost the elections. So they didn't do it before he had lost the elections, even though he had been spreading fake news and before that. And he had been lying through his hat. But they never did it. They waited for him to be voted out. When he was a lame duck president, that's when they came down upon him like a ton of bricks. Because they were also afraid that if they do it to him while he's in power, they might, because again, they're a business. So what I'm trying to say is that many times it's framed as a left-wing versus right-wing issue. No, it's more a question of who's in power versus who's not in power, composed with, yes, some of the personal biases of those that are in charge. Okay, so moving on to the next topic. This is a topic that, again, you'll say, well, how do you transition from this topic to the next topic? The reason is I've been wanting to talk about this for quite some time, and I felt that, you know, why not today? It's a topic which is very close to my heart, and I understand it might not be, this might catch many of my regular listeners. Why am I going to spend the next few minutes hearing about this? So please feel free to move away from this podcast for the next 30 minutes, or I don't know how long I'm going to be talking about it, but if this doesn't interest you. But I want to talk a little bit about dogs today. I could have talked about cats, but since I am a dog lover, so that's why I will talk about dogs. And I'm going to talk about it from a very specific perspective. So one question that I've always asked myself, and this actually happened after I visited several times at dog shelters, is to see the dogs that are abandoned there. Dogs abandoned by their owners. And I've always asked myself, and I've searched online, I've read it, conversations. I've even asked this once on my Twitter, that have you ever abandoned your dog? And why did you abandon your dog? So I've always been intrigued by this. As a dog lover, but also as somebody who likes to study the way human beings think, as an author, one of the, you know, for me, a good book is something which provides an insight into our existence or into the human mind that, not that we didn't realize it ourselves, but it's presented in a way that we find, well, that's a nice way of looking at things. So that's why I've always asked myself, why do dogs get abandoned? And the answer is very simple. I mean, from what I've read and even from what people have told me, I mean, they have different. So the usual thing is, you know, I'm moving away. I had a dog. When I took the dog, I didn't know what the responsibilities were.
My parents didn't let me keep the dog or something else. I moved to another place where the dog wasn't allowed.
But whatever it is, at the base of it, and there are many people who have a dog and they move, or they just don't move to a place where the dog is not allowed. So they will change their life because of the dog. And so ultimately what it comes down to is, why do people abandon dogs? It's because they abandon dogs because the dog does not love them in the way they felt they should be loved. So the expectation of love that they had when they had the dog was not met by the dog. And for those of you who understand where I'm going, is that this is exactly the reason why we abandon people too. That's why we stop being friends with people. That's why people get divorced. That's why people break off relationships. Because we abandon people too when we find that we are not getting the kind of love we thought we would get from them. And when I love, I don't necessarily mean just romantic love. I mean, the love between friends and even a sexual love, whatever it is, love in very, very, very general terms. Now, abandoning friends is also pretty easy in this day and age. When most friends are virtual, you just like unfriend them or block them. But when you're in a relationship, we often can't abandon people that easily. So many times the law or societal pressure or the possibility of being judged by other people prevents us from abandoning people as easily as we abandon pets, because there's usually not any kind of judgment if you just abandon your pet. I judge people, but I'm saying generally, if you abandon your pet, there isn't any kind of judgment that society puts on you because, hey, this guy has abandoned a dog. I've never heard anybody use that against anybody. So that's why I think that the fact that somebody abandons a dog, it's interesting to me because it kind of shows how human beings think and what human beings do when they know that there is no law or no social observation that is going on of their behavior, that they have absolutely no problem abandoning small dogs, puppies, dogs they barely know on the street, abandon them. And some of these are heartbreaking to see how these dogs are abandoned. And you would think that what is going through this person's mind when, a living being is begging and pleading like this not to be abandoned? What is going through this person? I, as a person who have no relationship with that dog, I can't watch this. How is this guy watching this? This guy must have some kind of affection or attachment to this dog, much more than I have. But yet, how is this person walking away? Which brings me to that point that the reason why that person is walking away, and I'm trying not to judge, is because the sum total of experiences that this person has had with that creature, with that dog, there is something there that actually overrides the natural tendency not to walk away from a living being, which again, I don't feel. So what exactly is that? Why do people abandon dogs? So on YouTube, there is, and YouTube recommends this on my feed, and so I sometimes watch it with almost like a morbid curiosity. So there's a street in Kolkata called Gallop Street, where there's a pet market. So you see, puppies being sold there to people. And just the way these puppies are, it's not just the fact that they're in cages. That's okay, I understand. In a commercial market, they'll be in cages. That's not what shocks me. What shocks and saddens me is how people buy these dogs. So they have small kids who go and buy dogs. Their parents are standing. The kids choose based on which dog is cute. And then the adults come in, they haggle over the price. They say, no, I can't buy this price. It's exactly as if they're buying fish that they're then going to slaughter and eat, which again, as a non-vegetarian, as a lover of fish, I'm not getting into that whole thing about that's a living being too. But with a dog, it's not, you're not buying the dog for food. You're buying the dog for something totally different. You're buying the dog for a long-term relationship. A dog lives for about an average of 15 years. You're going there looking for a relationship that's for 15 years. And this is how, with a living being, with emotions, a sentient living being with a high amount of emotions, this is the way you're approaching this. And it's so, it's not just one person who's doing this. It's a bunch of people who are doing it. So this is the start of the process of abandonment. The very reason why dogs get abandoned, and often also I believe that people get abandoned, is because when we get into these relationships, we do not think about that person, and we definitely do not think about who we are. So one of the primary reasons why dogs get abandoned, or there is, and I've seen this, you know, in the kind of brutality and dog abuse, is that the dog goes home and destroys things. So why do dogs go and destroy things? Dogs go and destroy things because different breeds have different kinds of energy levels. So that a dog which looks cute, for instance, a Labrador has a reputation of being destructive, much more destructive than I would say a Golden Retriever is. But a Golden Retriever can also be destructive, but a Labrador has just that slight thing that tips it over. And when why is this? Well, because these were all working dogs. They were all bred to do work. They were not bred to sit in homes and for people to go coochie-coo and for them to watch TV, roll over, have food. No. Now, some of these dogs could be trained. And again, people don't spend that time. I mean, if people don't spend the time even thinking about their own lifestyles, about the breeds, do you think these people will spend time in training? And I'm not talking about training as if teaching a dog tricks. It's something more than that. It's a more extensive form of training. That some of these dogs have the genetic material in them to be highly energetic. So when they do these things, people have this mental model that this dog will always be at their feet. These dogs will always be licking their toes. And the reason why people fall in love with the dogs is because they see, and it comes down to it, a kind of unquestioned love that does not require reciprocity. This is also why we sometimes walk into some human relationships also, because that's our expectation, that we will be accepted for who we are and we are not obliged to do anything. We kind of tend to think on those lines. But I deliberately do not want to get into human relationships, firstly because they're very complex, but for other reasons too. But with dogs, it's a simple thing. And since dogs are, you know, not treated as human beings, they're subhuman, these are things which we can talk about much more freely. So the point is, we expect the dog to be alive, of course, it's not a plant. But we expect the dog to always show love and not to have any problems. So if the dog barks too much, that's a problem. If the dog is destructive, and again, they bark too much is also a part of their behavior. So if you want to, you can train that out. Again, you might not be successful in training that out, but you have to train that out. But how can you expect people to do that when people go to a market and buy dogs in the way they would buy fish, where one dog breed is replaceable for the next? Without even understanding that is my lifestyle. For instance, some dogs, the terrier types, they require a lot of exercise. A German Shepherd requires a lot of exercise. They require a very active lifestyle. They need to run for miles a day. So if you cannot give them, if you keep a German Shepherd in a small apartment, of course that dog is going to be, you know, for that dog, it's like if somebody keeps us in solitary confinement in a prison in a small 8x8 room, what happens? Why is solitary confinement the worst kind of punishment that you can give a human being? Because it goes against the very grain of who we are. That's why. I mean, nobody's actually torturing you. I mean, you might be getting food being pushed in through the door two times a day, and you might be, you know, you're well fed, you know, you get the number of calories, and you would see this, you would think that this is a much better life if you are a poor person than living out in the street where you don't know where your next meal is going to come from. Your meal comes at a specific time. But still, it's not true. Even being hungry outside in the world is still a better fate than being inside a cell where you get your food and your clothing and medical care if you need it. Even that is still better than this. Why so? That is exactly why dogs behave the way they do, because they are not getting the amount of exercise. People in Calcutta, in warm areas, they will buy huskies because they are, you know, apparently cute. What they do not know, and they, again, a few 10, 15 years ago, I understand that, you know, people were not aware. Now, all you need to do is Google. It's all available there. First of all, you know, the Husky quote, that dog is bred for cold climate, snow. So if you are keeping that dog in a hot place, of course, the dog, it cannot express what the problem is. So the dog will engage in destructive behavior. So people buy dogs without knowing the first things about dogs. And sometimes people make very well-intentioned, they are well-intentioned, they make mistakes. For instance, one of the things that you should never do, especially when you take in a dog which is not a puppy but is a sheltered dog, or you know, you're rescuing a dog, you do not give the dog the full independence to roam about in your house, for instance, initially. So you give it in phases. You first confine the dog to a small area, which is that dog's area. And this is also something which helps the dog, because the world is perceived in a different way than we perceive it. So if somebody keeps us in a huge mall and totally empty mall and says, you can go anywhere you like, it is overwhelming for us. That's why when we join a new company, you know, our manager makes a 30, 60, 90 day plan. So it kind of, you kind of have a ramp up, you're gradually ramped up. So you have to, that's the way the brain works. When you're dealing with a huge amount of complexity, you need to ease that brain into that complexity. But if you come in, you rescue a dog and you let that dog have the full run of your house, the dog does not know how to behave. It stresses the dog out. And what then happens is the dog now thinks that all kinds of behavior is fine. So if you, for instance, let the dog on the couch one day because you were in the mood for it and the dog got on the couch, then that is the norm for the dog. The dog will not realize that, you know, the dog is usually not going to be able to make the fine distinction that he's allowed on the couch only when you're in a good mood and he's not allowed on the couch when you're in a bad mood. It's not, again, some dogs can, just like some human beings are smart, but most dogs can't. And another thing is, people sometimes say, we want to have an intelligent breed. Well, you actually don't want an intelligent breed, because an intelligent breed dogs, they actually can figure out. So if an intelligent dog realizes that the dog needs exercise and you are a couch potato, then that dog will, because they're intelligent, do something that will make you get up from your couch, which will be destructive behavior. So they know what kind of behavior, if they engage in, will get your attention. And they're very good at that. So this is just their way of trying to communicate. Understand that the dog doesn't have a notion of good or bad. So if it destroys your valuable book, the dog doesn't know what is a value. But the dog realizes, and especially smart dogs do, that there are some things, maybe if he chews, like his own toys, where he can keep on chewing the toy for hours and you are not going to notice, because that toy, you know, is his. He can chew on it. But if he chews on your expensive shoes, you will notice in a second. So that's exactly what they're going to do, because that is their objective. So this, after some time, for people who are not prepared for this, who do not want to spend the time training the dog, who haven't considered the energy levels of the dog or the breed, that's when they fall out of love with the dog. They realize it's too much of a trouble. It's too much of hassle. And that's why they, and again, does the dog not love the owner? Yes, it does. But And that's why the dog doesn't want the owner to leave, because again, the dog doesn't understand what it has done wrong, but the owner is just pissed off at that point of time. Whether they want to accept it or not, the owner's had enough. And again, this is exactly why we walk out of relationships, but our walking out of relationships is usually not as immediate as our decision to terminate a relationship with the dog. Because, you know, if a dog was bought from the market in the way you buy fish, then of course you will deal with a living being in the exact same way that you deal with rotten fish. You throw it into the garbage. And that's exactly what happens. You know, very, very expensive breed dogs are found out in Indian streets. And what happens with them is they don't survive. The moment you turn them out of the house, because they are not acclimatized to the local conditions, and because they've been kind of bred and reared in a sheltered atmosphere, they can't live out in the streets. Many of them just die immediately, because they're no match for, in the street dogs who have kind of grown up almost like urban wolves. So they can't deal with them at all. So again, I know this is not what we usually talk about in this blog. So I request those of you and my listeners who are thinking of getting a dog, this is for you. Please, please do your research when you decide to buy a dog. Please make sure that your lifestyles align with the dog. If you want a dog as a guard dog, for instance, do realize that that guard dog is going to bark at everything. So barking is going to be a problem. Some breeds bark a lot. Some breeds have a very specific kind of quote-unquote irritating bark, which triggers human beings. Example, the beagle. Very cute looking dog. Very, very difficult dog to have. Breed of dog to have. Beagles are extensively used in lab experiments because they're otherwise very gentle dogs. They don't bite per se, but they're extremely extreme. They eat everything. They get out. I mean, they basically push your triggers continuously for attention. They're not violent dogs at all. That's why they're used for experiments, because they're not violent dogs. They don't snarl. They don't bite usually. They're very tolerant dogs. But just like they're tolerant of you, they expect you to be tolerant of them. So again, do not buy dogs just because they look cute. Buy dogs. And I've talked to colleagues here. You know, once I was talking to a colleague and the colleague was saying, I have to get a dog for my kid. You know, my kid really wants a dog. And then he said, I actually bought a book of dogs. You know, look at all these cute pictures, and we were deciding. And I had to tell this person that, can I just say something over here? Please don't buy a dog like this. And he was like, kind of like, wait, what? I said, no, please don't buy a dog like this. Let me just tell you that, you know, and I basically told him what I'm saying, you know, a much abridged version of this, that please consider, you know, how much space you'll be able to give the dog. Please consider your lifestyle. And I asked him, you know, are you somebody who's going to take your dog running? Because this person was looking at a German Shepherd. Said, you know, I was thinking of a German Shepherd. You know, they look very muscular dogs. I've always liked German Shepherds. So, you know, why do you like German Shepherds? German Shepherds are very smart dogs, by the way. Very, very. That's why they're used as canine dogs, because they're very smart. So, and this guy lives a sedentary lifestyle. So again, this is not a good dog for him. This is, again, good. Are there isolated examples where things will work out? Yeah, sure. But odds are they won't. That's why if you go to the shelters, the most, at least over here, the predominant group of dogs that are abandoned are pit bulls, of course, and German Shepherds. German Shepherds are expensive dogs. And pit bulls aren't that expensive, but German Shepherds are very expensive dogs. And they're abandoned. I would say they're like 20% of all dogs I've seen abandoned are German Shepherds. Because of this reason, people have a fascination towards German Shepherds, but they don't understand the other factors of a German Shepherd. Also, the fact that the German Shepherd has a great bite strength. Also, I had gone to the ER once for a medical issue of mine, and I saw this person sit in front of me. His like entire shirt was like splattered with his own blood, and you know there was a. So over here, when you have an injury like this, the hospital won't take you in. I mean, they first ask you a question: are you going to press charges against anybody? So that's when I heard, you know, how does this happen? We have to, you know, do you want to call the police? And this is, no, it's my dog. My dog bit me. And then they took an advantage. They asked what kind of a dog? And he said, German Shepherd. That's how I heard. So why do these things happen? And again, I'm not saying that everything that, you know, well-adjusted, well-trained dog can also turn on their owner. That also happens. But usually that doesn't happen. That's, again, a rare thing. So again, if you're planning to get a dog, please, please do your breed research. Please understand that different dogs are different. They have different expectations. They behave very differently. And also know who you are and ask yourself very honest questions, that can I spend this amount of effort on a dog? For instance, you know, getting a puppy, people love puppies. I mean, who doesn't love a puppy face? But you know, the first about 6 months to a year of raising a puppy is it's like having a child. It's like having a human child at that point of time. So consider that. also consider, you know, for those who are adopting, again, consider. So one of the reasons why many adoptions fail often is the history of the dog. If the dog was taken away from its litter, this litter of brothers and sisters when they were very young, either because the litter died or because of, you know, the litter was separated, that dog is likely to have certain problems. The problem is that in the initial few months, as most of you know, that dogs 15 years is equivalent to, let's say, our 100 years. So by the time a dog is 1 year old, it's essentially like us at 20 years old, or, you know, they may be even 18 or 19 at that kind. So that's like the teenage years is 1 year or something. So a dog matures much faster than human beings, of course, but it goes through roughly the same kind of phases and the same kind of behavioral changes. So in the first 8 weeks of a dog's childhood, that's when their, basically their neural pathways are being created. So if there is something which is very disruptive that happens, then that dog is essentially is scarred for life. Their way of interpreting their environment is different from other dogs. As an example, one of the things that little puppies do when they're in a litter is that they mouth each other, that they collaborate among themselves to take their mother's milk. If they haven't gone through that experiences, they are more likely to be dog reactive, and they are likely to be very reactive to their food. That is, they won't let anybody get near their food. They will be very threatening of other dogs. They will snarl at other dogs. They will attack other dogs because they have not been brought up in a litter. They will be tendency to be dominant. They will be more aggressive. So when they were growing up, they kind of didn't get that kind of soft love, that kind of brotherly love, that kind of maternal affection. And that affects them in the same way it affects human beings who are raised without the love of their parents, who are raised without family. They become hard. They become, you know, unnecessarily hard and aggressive and mistrustful. And because that's the way their brain has been wired, that any food that I get, I might not get it. I have no security. The world is out against me. That becomes a part of who they are. So these are the kind of dogs who end up getting abandoned again and again and again. I've seen like people here at local shelters. One dog has been abandoned 4 or 5 times. A dog is a very cute looking dog. How can this dog be brought back 4 or 5 times? There's something about the dog which people cannot fall in love with. And so again, I'm a dog lover, but I'm not one of those like religious dog lovers. So I do understand that dogs and human beings are not the same. but for human beings who are thinking of getting a dog, please, please, please do consider whether you are ready for a dog, whether the living conditions that you are ready for a dog. And definitely don't go to a place and just shop around for dogs and buy one based on their cuteness or because your child likes this dog. Do not gift anybody a dog. You know, a dog is a living being, and it's a very complex living being. It's a complex living being whose attitude and whose behavior is in many ways a function of how it was brought up as well as its genetic disposition. It's very, very similar to a human being. If you want to have something which is a much less complicated thing, have plants in your home. That would be my advice. But if you're going to invest in an intelligent, sentient being, please do due diligence, because there is very few little things. There are very few things which are as tragic as an abandoned dog. With that, I will conclude today's podcast. Have a nice week, and I will see you next week. Bye-bye.